For years, many Hollywood actors, agents, and writers have turned to two therapists for help with their problems. And now Phil Stutz and Barry Michaels have written a book about their popular approach to dealing with life's challenges. It's called The Tools, Transform Your Problems into Courage, Confidence, and Creativity, and it's published by Spiegel & Grau. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show today, and we invite your calls. A little later, we'll take some listener calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Phil, you were the one who developed this approach. Was there something specific that you felt you hadn't gotten from what you'd learned during your formal training in psychotherapy?
Yeah, there was. There was an urgency to the process that I wasn't prepared to deal with in my training. And basically what it was there were people in pain. They were suffering. And they wanted results, or at least they wanted some respite from the suffering immediately.
So you just said, forget Freud, forget Adler, forget all of that. Maybe keep a little Jung and come up with something else?
It wasn't that radical. It developed slowly, you know, in steps over years. And I didn't find it necessary to throw anything out. It was just it was a component that was missing. It was the immediacy, the urgency. And people need hope, you know, so they need to feel they can get help immediately, that they can feel and they can experience.
But isn't that, there are schools of therapy, more traditional schools like Gestalt therapy, that would say pretty much the same thing, no?
They might. I'm sure they would. This was my particular way of meeting that.
And how did you develop these tools?
Well, it was funny. I set a standard for myself, which is when someone came in with a problem, I felt I had to respond to that problem immediately, right at that second. And at the beginning, I was very young. I was 28, 29 years old. I was kind of speaking off the top of my head. But psychiatry, the problems tend to recur. So, you know, somebody will ask you a question, let's say about depression. The next day, somebody else is going to ask you a question that's going to be very similar to the first one. And, you know, so you work on the same problems over and over and over again. The funny thing about the tools is when you get a tool that works, you can feel it, and the patient can feel it. And basically, my standard was that the patient considered the thing workable.
Well, what's the difference between what you've developed and behavior modification?
That's a good question.
The difference, I mean, I can speak to the difference. One of the differences is that behavior modification, if you study the theoretical orientation behind it, it doesn't really have a lot of depth to it. In other words, it's basically considering the human being as kind of a programmable computer, a complex computer, but a computer, not so much with a soul. What Phil and I do really is meld two extremes in psychotherapy. Depth, which has the ability to explain why people have their problems, but doesn't really have tools to address them, and cognitive behavioral therapy, which has tools but doesn't really explain to a human being.
Well, I have to tell you, Barry, I've never been convinced by these shortcut psychological approaches like EST, for example. We won't even mention Scientology. What was it about Phil's approach that appealed to you?
It was exactly what I was saying, is that it melded, it was a very deep approach. In other words, it had the advantage of explaining to the patient why they had their problem and how their problem fit into universal human conflicts, but it also had solutions at the same time. See, what the cognitive behavioral approach misses is the human need for meaning. And Phil's approach never missed that at all.
Did you already have your own practice when you learned about Phil?
It was small. I was really just starting out. I had just graduated and gotten my license.
Now, Phil, you worked as a prison psychiatrist on Rikers Island, didn't you?
Yeah.
That was early in your career. Do you think that experience has influenced your approach?
No, I didn't feel it particularly influenced my approach. Actually, the reason I finally left that place was I was becoming more like a correction officer than a psychiatrist. Well, I'll say one thing about it. There was, you know, in a prison, there's a demand. The person that speaking to usually the man is for Valium at that time, and it was to prove that they were innocent. You know, every guy in prison said, "I did not commit this crime that I'm indicted for," but they all said, "I'm the best criminal you could ever meet, but this particular crime I was innocent of." But other than trying to, mostly my response to the pressure was to say no. And it wasn't this, you know, the same thing as my private practice.
One thing you've told me, Phil, is that in prison you were subjected to forces, vibes from people
right.
that you weren't necessarily subjected to in a typical therapy situation. And I do think that that may have influenced you in terms of the tools, because the tools activate forces.
Well, you describe the tools as a way to access what you call higher forces.
Correct.
What do you mean by that? Are we talking about the same sort of thing that AA is talking about?
For me, yes, we are.
You know, there are people who object to AA mainly because even though they want to end their alcoholism, they are uncomfortable with making it into a religious experience.
Yes, and we're very, very clear with patients. In fact, it never comes up, actually, in therapy, because we're not selling a dogma or a belief system to people. What we're trying to do is relieve them of pain in a way that changes their life and activates potential that they never had before. Now, where that potential comes from is, to me, up to the patient to explain to himself. If he thinks it comes from his unconscious, that's fine with me. If he thinks it comes from a higher force, that's fine with me. If he thinks it comes from himself, that's fine with me. Remember, we're not a religion. We're not trying to sell dogma. We're really just trying to help people and heal them.
Yeah, the whole point for me is we're going to give you something to do. We'll give you a little theoretical background, but you judge it for yourself. Both of us are adamant about that. In other words, your own felt experience will either confirm or deny what we're saying, and we're both very comfortable with doing that.
Now, in classical therapy, the therapist does not do all that much talking initially,
yeah.
and sometimes responds.
Yeah.
But you include cues for when you're using these tools. So you believe that this should be a more interactive approach?
Yes. One of the things that people generally complain of to us about prior experiences in therapy is the therapist never said anything to me. I'll confess openly, I went to a therapist when I was 18 years old. I went to one session, and the therapist literally said nothing through the entire session until about two-thirds of the way through, when I was explaining something about a girlfriend of mine, and he said, "Wait, stop a moment, and repeat what you just said," and I repeated it, and he turned on a tape recorder to record what I was, and that was it. That was all I heard from the guy. What our patients...
Don't you think that was just a bad therapist?
Very possibly. I mean, it was definitely a bad therapist, but I do know, I knew something about psychotherapy at the time, and I know that that was actually part of analytic technique, was to say as little as possible so that the patient would project upon you, and there was a whole theoretical justification for that. Most patients don't like that, and they don't get it. They don't get why they're paying someone to simply sit and listen.
Yeah, I think something has developed over years and years and years in psychotherapy where you can't just talk to the person like a person, and it's not natural for me, and I don't think it's helpful. Whether you call it therapy, you call it helping a friend or whatever, they want to be addressed directly as a peer, as far as I'm concerned, and they want to know that you understand what they're feeling, and they also want to know that you have some kind of a solution. Doesn't it be a magical solution?
Well, you present four tools in this book. Do they deal with the most common problems that your patients bring to you?
Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Do these problems usually crop up when people are trying to deal with setbacks, or are they just part of normal life?
I would say yes.
I would say that they're part of normal life. A lot of them are. Certainly the first one, which is called the reversal of desire, is dealing with the problem of avoidance. And avoidance, at least in our society, is endemic to our society. We don't do the things that we know that we need to do for ourselves, whether it's staying on a diet, exercising, starting the novel we always wanted to write, etc.
Well, the reversal of desire chapter suggests that there's an emphasis on staying with the moment you're in not the anticipation of fear or pain. It sounds a bit like Zen Buddhism. And I know a fair number of the people who are your patients are actors. I can see where advising someone to stay in the moment would appeal to an actor. After all, that's what they do as actors.
Well, the reversal desire does a little bit more than that. In other words, in the moment is some kind of pain. There's something that the person is having trouble dealing with. So you could say it's staying in the moment, but it's a very aggressive staying in the moment. It's staying in that part of the moment that you avoid that feels intolerable. You could certainly say it's staying in the moment, but it's not, that's not the major way I think about it. Mm-hmm.
If you want to say it differently, it's staying in the moment in the sense that it's not analyzing the pain from outside of the pain. The tool teaches you to drive through pain so that you can be stronger. I mean, if you analyze, if you look at people who accomplish a lot in life, they drive through tremendous amounts of pain all day, every day. That's how they accomplish what they want to accomplish.
Well, I asked you earlier about how this is different from behavior modification. Well, that aversive therapy is part of behavior modification. You can be put into a situation that is the thing you fear the most, and you get past it, and then you don't fear it anymore.
Absolutely. And in this just narrow respect, the reversal of desire is very much like behavior modification. What Phil added is a whole understanding of forces in the human being, particularly the force of desire. Behavior modification doesn't talk about desiring pain. It just talks about putting yourself in aversive situations. What we're really trying to teach people is something much broader, which is that if they can learn to desire pain in a specific area, they'll learn to desire pain in lots of different areas of their lives. And most of the pain that we avoid is not only survivable, it opens up your life.
Right, I mean, so we should desire pain?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, that doesn't make you a masochist, because the types of pain that we're talking about are not desired for their own sake. They're desired because they lead to good things for you, whether it's the pain of depriving yourself of a food that's not on your diet, or the pain of getting yourself to exercise, or the pain of starting a new business.
Most people live in some kind of a comfort zone, you know, one way or the other. So what we're saying is success, but also self-regard, happiness, depends on forcing yourself out of that zone.
Well, I go to exercise mainly because I pay a high monthly fee to go to exercise. I don't know if that, I just feel like, well, gee, I'm throwing my money away if I don't go.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different kind of motivator, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, luckily, you don't really have that much of an avoidance in that area.
But, oh, gosh, I sure do.
Well, you've found a way around it, which is good.
There are days. My guests are Phil Stutz and Barry Michaels. Their book, The Tools, Transform Your Problems into Courage, Confidence, and Creativity, is published by Spiegel & Grau. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with our guests, Phil Stutz and Barry Michaels. Their book, The Tools, Transform Your Problems into Courage, Confidence, and Creativity, published by Spiegel & Grau. Our listeners are all intrigued, and they want more details just how these tools work. So where should we start with examples? Okay, we talked a bit about the reversal of desire. What are some of the other tools?
Active love is a tool that people use to overcome anger. You know, typically when someone wrongs us, we get into what Phil and I call the maze, which is basically we get trapped in our anger, going over it and over it in our heads, what the person did to us, plotting revenge, holding a grudge, etc. That doesn't really help the situation. It doesn't help you overcome the anger, and it usually doesn't result in the other person apologizing or anything. You just get stuck as life passes you by. Active love enables you to let go of the way in which the person injured you and move past it.
Why do you think we tend to hang on to the idea that the world should treat us more fairly?
I think it's a childlike belief. I mean, children have this sense that it's, and I think it's just inbred, that if they are good, the world will be good to them. It's a basic kind of primitive sense of fairness.
that if I do a good job, my boss will give me a raise.
Exactly.
Yeah, it gives you a sense of control over the, over a universe that's really not controlled.
I learned that lesson the hard way.
yeah, I mean, 3 seconds in the world teaches you that that's wrong, but there's still this primitive part of us that likes to hold on to it.
And you say using active love allows people to tap into the higher force you call outflow?
Correct.
Yeah, outflow is unconditional acceptance. In other words, we call it love, but the relevance of the concept of love in this discussion is that it allows you to accept things absolutely unconditionally. If someone mistreats you and you can accept it completely, you can move beyond it. If you can't, life passes you by.
Does this involve visualizing?
To an extent, it involves visualizing.
People, or doing something specific?
No, it doesn't involve doing anything specific. It involves a little bit of visualization. Excuse me. I'm not particularly good at visualizing, though, and I use the tool regularly.
Athletes do it all the time.
Athletes do it all the time.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Now, we were just talking to Scott Jurek, who runs, and said that when he started running, it gave him a chance to think. Different people have different ways of dealing with things. Is that a good way? Doing physical exercise alone and running 100 miles?
Is it a good way to let go of anger? Absolutely. I think exercise is fantastic for a lot of different...
Yeah. I also think the exercise model or the athletic model, for me, actually comes closer to real life than a lot of these psychoanalytic models.
Now, you also say that this is a matter of tuning out the chatter. Wouldn't that appeal more to someone in a city like Los Angeles or New York where there is so much chatter and less so in other parts of the country?
I don't think so. In other words, if someone has treated you unfairly or you believe they treated you unfairly, you create your own static. So there's a self-created noise in your own head. And not only is it distracting and does it waste time, but it destroys your confidence in yourself because people feel like they've lost control of their own thought processes. And that's, by the way, a general premise of all these tools is to give the person back some sense of control of themselves. Nobody's going to have control of events or of the future. That's impossible.
So I'm just trying to understand. Somebody has done something really awful to us.
Yeah.
This does happen. And I'm to apply active love?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Now, do you understand why?
Well, I'm still trying to understand what I do about the fact that that person doesn't realize often that he or she has done something to
us. There you go. That's the maze.
That's the maze, is that everyone focuses on the person who inflicted the harm. If they use active love first, what happens is they calm down.
Okay, so that's you calm down.
That's a much better...
You calm down, but that still doesn't correct the situation. That person has said something awful or humiliated me in a social situation. Or
no, but think of it, Leonard. It's much better...
A spouse cheats on a husband.
It's much better. It's much better to make a decision about what to do to that from a calm place than from the maze, mm-hmm. where you have to confront the person.
So you're just saying that the real trick is just calming down?
Well, what we're saying is that the active love tool not only helps you calm down, it actually helps you get past the injury so that you're no longer looking to the person who injured you for any kind of rectification. If you look to them to rectify the injury, you're giving them power that they shouldn't have.
But they're moving along perfectly happily, and they're going to do that to somebody else as well.
And
isn't it important to tell them that perhaps their behavior is a bit destructive?
Yeah, let me tell you, that's a good point. In active love is to control your state. From that, if I was going to punch you in the nose, I would send active love first, because at that point I'm more relaxed. I'm in harmony with myself. And I don't need a particular reaction from you. I don't need for you to say, wow, that was a very strong punch. So it's a matter of ordering things. And the inner peace that comes from that and the letting go, that's what you're really talking about, has to take priority.
In general, our tools work from the inside out.
But how is this different than forgiveness?
Let me just finish. Yeah. We're big proponents of let's get control of what's going on inside of you. Then you're in a much more powerful position to do whatever it is you feel is right in the outside world.
But that's forgiveness, isn't it?
It's connected to forgiveness, but forgiveness usually implies a thought process. like, for instance, I forgive the person because I understand what they went through, etc. This, and that's fine, and the tool will help you with that, but this is a deeper thing. This is prior to forgiveness. In other words, this is getting yourself in a state where you've let go of the thing, whether you forgive it or not.
It's really allowing your mind to stop ruminating about the wrong so that you can then decide whether or not I want to forgive the person or not. There are people I've never forgiven for certain things they did to me, but I don't think about them all the time.
You don't keep on remembering, that creep.
I'm not plagued by it.
You write that to deal with our insecurity and intimidation, we can use the tool of inner authority. This is something that grows out of Carl Jung?
Part of the tool involves the shadow, which is the part of you that you're most insecure about.
That was Jung's idea, the shadow.
That was Jung's idea, yeah. But what I felt was the idea could be pushed a little bit farther. He didn't give you a real-time dynamic way to work with the shadow relative to the problems that you're having.
Don't most people want to avoid their shadow because it's often the embodiment of their insecurities?
And that's exactly what causes the problem, which is when you avoid the shadow or try to hide it from other people, it's impossible to express yourself confidently because you're too busy scrutinizing the other person to see whether or not they see your shadow.
Yeah.
It creates insecurity to hide the shadow.
You become more concerned with what they think of you than what it is that you want to say.
Now, you also write about a tool that helps you to keep using the other tool.
Right.
So how does Jeopardy work?
Well, you can explain that if you want, Phil. But what I want to say is this goes back to the first question that you asked, which is the implication that this is a quick fix, you know, something like Est or whatever. We're actually the opposite of that. In other words, we want people to use tools in a way that they'll be able to say, I worked harder on this than anything I worked on in my life. In other words, we think the book needs to be read two or three times and the tools need to be used forever. Just the way an athlete would say, I need to keep my body in condition forever. And that's why we included the fifth tool, was that it enabled people to keep doing that.
A listener asked how this is different from dialectical behavioral therapy, this sort of thing that's used for anorexia, which sounds very similar to him.
DBT is a very good form of therapy for many, many different problems. The difference between what we do and DBT is that DBT works mostly on thought processes, whereas most of what our tools do is move you away from thinking. Thinking is actually part of the problem, and it tries to get you in touch with forces inside of you. For example, if you're facing something that you're scared of, you can't think about it. That won't actually diminish the fear. Courage is a force that will overcome the fear.
I mentioned that you have some pretty famous patients. Hasn't your office been ransacked by people looking for their files?
No, although that's a nightmare that I live with every day.
Mine was once.
Mm-hmm. It's good to change the names of famous people on the files,
right,
too. Give them a code name.
We don't want anyone from the Sun in Britain, now that the News of the World is no longer being published, going to your offices. Phil Stutz and Barry Michaels, their book, The Tools, Transform Your Problems into Courage, Confidence, and Creativity. It's published by Spiegel and Grau. And thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thanks so much
thank
for having
you.
Us.